Broadcasting live statewide from the Civic Media Studios in Green Bay, this is Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, your inside source on everything entertainment from Wisconsin to Hollywood. And now, a guy who binge watches TV for a living but doesn't get paid, Pete Schwabba.
All right. Welcome to Nightlight, folks. Let's kick this week off in style with a new round of discussion about TV and movies and entertainment and all the things that bring us together. Got a great show for you tonight. Great to have you with me on this Monday evening. You can still have a night light, even though it's still light outside, right, Conrad?
I mean, yeah, it's gets light or nighttime in an hour. So
I agree. You know what?
We're winding them down for that.
There you go. I just turned off the lights of the studio.
Yeah.
I made it look more night light-ish. Because we got to give the illusion. But we still got to light it up here. So, got a fun show tonight. I'm very excited. One of my guests tonight is an author and a filmmaker and an activist. His name is Roger Rappaport. He'll be here at 7:35. He wrote a book about Patty Hearst called The Search for Patty Hearst, A True Crime Story. He will be here at 7:35. This will be the second time I've interviewed Roger. He was a guest on a TV show I host on PBS Wisconsin, and I got to interview him about a film he made called Pilot Air. He really just, like, I make jokes. I use the phrase deep dive a lot on this show when it isn't really warranted, but Roger does a deep dive into everything he does. He's a journalist. He worked for the New York Times and Rolling Stone, and he's this guy that just does his homework. So I cannot wait to interview him tonight, and we're going to talk about his book about Patty Hearst, a really fantastic and just really intriguing story that was, you know, kind of took over the American airwaves in the mid-70s. I was just a tiny tyke then, but I remember reading about it, and of course her great-grandfather was William Randolph Hearst, who the movie Citizen Kane was based on. So it'll be fun to talk to Roger. And then in the second hour, we keep it a little lighter, a little comedy. Tracy Schrader will be here. She is an Appleton-based stand-up comedian, and she will be here in the second hour. I had the pleasure of meeting Tracy and seeing a set she did about 3 years ago in Marinette at a football fundraiser that I book up there. Coincidentally, I did not book Tracy at it. She came along with another comedian and did a set, and it was just great. So I'm excited to have her on the show. She will be in studio in the second hour. That'll be a good time. And that's a fun show. That's two different, very different interviews, Conrad. Patty Hearst, true crime.
Yeah.
Tracy Schrader, comedy. I mean, are we bringing it or what?
It's a great Monday.
It's a great Monday. It's a great way to kick off the week. And what a weekend it was.
Yeah.
Before we jump in, I just want to give a shout out and congratulate all of my colleagues here at Civic Media that won awards. And frankly, I don't think I could name all of them. So let's just do kind of a blanket. First of all, I know Todd Michaels.
Yeah.
Crushed it.
He did.
Producerially speaking, with Mino and the Mayor for WGBW, WISS. Conrad, my compadre, was involved in one of the awards. Tell us what you did, Conrad.
Yeah, so on Thanksgiving Day, we went down to by the veterans, and Mino and the Mayor did a live show, and it was like my fifth day as a producer, but it was a cool welcome. I helped produce the show that day.
You and Amanda Nimmer here from
yep,
WGBW
yes.
as well. You guys both crushed it too, and that's exciting. And Mino and the Mayor, I think, took second for Wisconsin Morning Show. I'm getting it confused, though, because John and Gordy got nominated, too, for the Madison Morning Show. They took home some type of an award. Jorge Reyna, I think, won first place for an article he wrote about Max Inc. and our friend Terry Barr. And I think they won some type of award. Let's pull up those awards. We can name them all. What are we doing here? You know, I mean, we don't have time to talk about great success. Of course we do. Maggie Dawn won. WFHR crushed it, too. They won, like, four or five awards. Melissa Kay was on the show last week, I want to say, and she won a first-place award for something, too. And she's part of the She does a great job with news too, but she also does the WFHR morning show, I think with James Maloof. I haven't even met everyone at Civic Media because we're all over the state and we get together every week for these Zoom meetings and it's kind of cool to see everybody's faces, but there are people I haven't even met that I work with. So have you met everyone? You haven't even met everyone here at WGBW and there's like six people that work here.
Yeah, no, I haven't met everyone yet.
It's crazy. But it's a good company.
Yes.
Year one.
Yeah.
And they really brought home the bacon, so to speak. So we'll pull up a list and do we'll get some names out there too. Maybe an hour or two we'll do that. Before we get too deep into the show, I want to say that Nightlight with Pete Schwabe is sponsored by the Minocqua Brewing Company, who is making Wisconsin great again one beer at a time. Check out their webpage, minocquabrewingcompany.com, to see where you can buy progressive beer and join them for live music, poetry, and progressive politics at their new tap room on 2927 East Washington Avenue in Madison, Wisconsin. Coincidentally, I will be there tomorrow night. We'll be doing a remote from the Minocqua Brewing Company on East Wash. So if you are in the Madison area, pardon me, or don't mind a road trip, stop on by. We're going to have a really fun time tomorrow night. Conrad will be producing the show from here, but we will have John and Gordy from the WMDX Morning Show will be on. I'm going to pull up my list here of guests. We got a lot of guests tomorrow night. Kirk Bangstad and Susan Gettert will sing. Richard Vargas will read poetry. And then Tommy Bentz. Am I getting that name right, Conrad? I just added him to the list.
It's definitely.
Tommy Bentz. Yeah. We'll be playing live music. I think we'll be playing live music, but he'll be there. It's going to be a really fun show. It's going to be a fun night. It's our first remote here at Nightlight with our first sponsor. Very excited to do the show from Madison tomorrow night and leave Conrad unsupervised.
I don't know if you should do that.
I don't know. We'll see. You've been doing a pretty good job. I'm starting to. There's trust building here between you and Civic Media, I think. I always trusted you, but... So there'll be a lot of stuff happened this weekend too. I saw The Fall Guy and you saw Unfrosted.
Yeah.
Two big releases. So let's talk about, I got about 40 minutes through Unfrosted.
Yeah.
That's Jerry Seinfeld's new movie about the creation of Pop-Tarts with everybody in their comedy, tons of comedians in this thing. And it was a little corny what I saw. I'm going to finish it probably tonight or tomorrow, but it's not like I didn't enjoy it. I saw some friends in the movie. That was kind of fun. What did you think?
Well, you were right. It is corny, but you get through the whole movie and you're like, all right, well, that was a fun little comedy. It was only an hour and a half, not that big of a watch, you know, but it's very loosely based on what actually happened. So
I did not know that.
It's very, very, very loosely. I think there's one person that's actually true.
It's very loosely based, meaning that cereal does exist.
Yeah.
And they're making fun of it.
Pop-Tarts do exist right. too. But I forget her name, but the lady who is the post.
Amy Schumer played?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She is actually true.
Is that right? She's based on a real character.
I don't think the Kellogg's person is, though.
You mean Jim Gaffigan didn't start Kellogg's?
I don't think so.
Never know. I mean, it was really, it's like total Seinfeld humor, though. It's like, and I don't mean to demean like, you give a guy like Jerry Seinfeld a premise where he loves cereal to begin with. He's always eating it on the show Seinfeld, but where you can just kind of make jokes about history. And that's kind of what they do. They look back and laugh at everything. So, but great comedians in it.
Yeah.
And good performances. You know.
There's one part in it that's really funny. It's Seinfeld is just sleeping and he's sleeping on a bag of cereal. Like, that's his pillow.
Yeah, it was funny. There were some good jokes. They talked about creating all the different, like, what they wanted to compete with Pop-Tarts and what they were putting in these little breakfast cakes. And it was just disgusting, some of the stuff. Like a pitch meeting. That was kind of funny.
Yeah.
I did not. Okay, so I went and saw Fall Guy last night. And I got to tell you, I know that overall, people are kind of disappointed. People. The theaters, studios are kind of disappointed in the numbers Fall Guy did. It did almost $30 million over the weekend, which sounds like a lot of money, but it like brought in half of what Guardians of the Galaxy 3 brought in last year, which was the opening of the summer blockbuster season. And numbers are down, but the movie is just not that good. It's like It's like a rom-com. It's like bad Lifetime dialogue mixed in with crazy stunts that are so unbelievable. It's ridiculous. It almost does a disservice to stuntmen by showing how outlandish some of this stuff is. The story is contrived. It's almost like the director set out to make a summer blockbuster and tried to hit all these benchmarks as to what should be in the film. Pushing aside story, there's one scene in it where Emily Blunt, she's directing her first big movie, but somehow finds time to go do karaoke. And, you know, you got to take breaks during filming. I get that, but she wants Ryan Gosling to meet her there. They had a love affair and he got injured. And now they're trying to mend things back together. And she sings a song from Against All Odds at karaoke. No jokes. Like, she's just singing. And then they cut occasionally to him doing these stunts, trying to, it was just so weird. And I think the whole movie was kind of tongue in cheek, but man, if you're going to do that, you better have the audience in on that. They better understand that you're doing that. And I went last night by myself. There was only 7 other people in the audience. And I heard maybe like 2 chuckles the whole movie. Like,
oh wow.
It did not go over well.
That's kind of depressing.
It is. And, you know, having said that, the ending was kind of cool. There were some scenes I liked, but it just was not a good movie. So I can't remember exactly what Rob Thomas said on Friday. He didn't love it. I remember he thought there were some nice moments, but whew, it just did not land for me. And I hope that's not. Mad Max opens soon, and I think that will crush it. The first one was unbelievable. But right now, if this is our, you know, if this is the movie that kicked everything off, it's no Barbenheimer. I'll say that. Of course, that's 2 movies. But Roger Rappaport, author, filmmaker, activist, will be here at 7:35 to discuss his book about Patty Hearst. Very much looking forward to talking to Roger, and comedian Tracy Schrader will be here in the second hour. Lots to discuss. We're going to hit on the Tom Brady roast. Seinfeld showed up on SNL. He's been all over the place saying crazy stuff. And we're going to talk about nude cruises next. Would you do it? We haven't even done our question yet, Conrad. It's National Beverage Day. What beverage do you enjoy the most watching TV or movies? That's our question on National Beverage Day. What do you enjoy the most watching TV or movies when it comes to beverages? Let us know at 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. I'm going to ask Conrad if he would do a nude cruise. That's next. A Nightlight with Peach Wabba. And it breaks my heart. From when it did I fall.
I wanna cry, cry, cry.
You and a loved one. Or just you, can go on a naked cruise. It's called the Big Nude Boat to Baradice. Get it? B-A-R-E, dice, Baradice. I heard Todd Alba talking about this today, and it was so funny. I'm like, I have to talk about this because it's, you know, I know there's nudists out there, and there are people that, you know, go to, like, nude beaches and stuff like that, but I've never done something like that. I've always wanted to. No, but Todd was asking people, would you do that? Would you go on a naked cruise? I'm not saying I wouldn't, but I would need to know first before I'm walking around in my all together. I want to know who else is doing it. I want to see the clientele first. I want to see what I'm looking at. Is that unreasonable?
No.
I mean, what if it's me and a bunch of 85-year-old people? I'm not doing that.
Like they're going into a YMCA locker room.
Yeah, exactly. You ever do that? That's awful.
Yeah.
Those guys, man, they can't get enough of their own nudity. And I'm like, they have not seen themselves in years. This is not right.
Yeah, no. It, especially if you're a younger kid and you're just trying to get to play basketball.
It's terrible. I would not. I mean, some guys, you know, they're overdoing it too. They got one leg up on the bench talking, like they're standing in a way you'd never stand.
Yeah.
Trying to like, and it's like, you know, why don't you do some sit-ups, do a little more grooming, and then flaunt yourself around your 85-year-old body around the Y locker room. Crazy. But I don't know. I don't think I would do, I'm not saying I wouldn't do it. If I could talk my wife into it, maybe. But I honestly, I would have to know that the other people are somewhat okay to look at. Because if you're bearing all, you want to get your money's worth. And you want to make sure if you're being looked at, you're enjoying the view as well. And look, I'm not saying, believe me, I'm not saying people are getting their money's worth. Look at me. I could do some sit-ups, some squat thrusts, and I would have the decency to not do them naked. I don't know. Would you do it, Conrad?
See, this is, I didn't read anything about it. I just saw like nude crews coming. And I'm like, does that include like the whole cruise?
Well, you have to wear clothes when you go through the food line, which I think is smart.
That is very smart.
I don't want to know how all the bartender's stirring my drinks. I just want to know, yeah, for the essential things on the cruise, food, beverages, all that, you have to remain clothed.
Okay. That was a question. I was like,
yeah.
If you're going to dinner.
That was your biggest question.
Like, I don't want to see any of that when I'm eating.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and if you have to stomach everybody else seeing naked people, that defeats the whole purpose, too.
Yeah.
Put some clothes on, and let's all have a good time.
Honestly, though, I don't think I would do that.
No, I wouldn't either. I would need some sort of incentive or, like, you know, if my wife begged me to go on a naked cruise or to do something naked, that would tell me she's really tired of seeing me naked. But I would just say, go to the interwebs. There's tons of nude people. So I'm told. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. I'm looking at the pictures, too, on the website. And they actually, you know, I mean, some of these pictures, they're like, it's called Cruise Bear. Just in case anybody wants to go, it's cruisebear.com. So check it out. The cruises start in February. But don't worry, fellas. It's in a warm climate. Yeah, that's not for me, I don't think.
Well, if you're from Wisconsin, you might have to do a spray tan before you go February.
Exactly. Coming up in just a few minutes. Oh, our question again, by the way, I kind of felt rushed before because I was yakking away about the movies this weekend, but it is National Beverage Day. Also National Nurses Day. That's pretty cool. If you have a nurse you want to recognize, text us. We'll read it on the air. Nurses do great work. Nurses and teachers, really, you can't, they're just selfless people. And I immediately, I'm not saying there aren't teachers or nurses that aren't nice people, but I automatically kind of give people props when I find out they're a nurse or a teacher. But it is National Nurses Day. That's cool. National Beverage Day. So our question tonight is, what is your favorite beverage to have while watching a movie or TV? We were talking about Unfrosted before, the new Jerry Seinfeld movie. He wrote it, directed it, and stars in it. It's on Netflix. And, you know, let's say you're sitting down to watch Unfrosted, like Chris Casper did this weekend. He liked it, by the way. I got a text from Chris. Does so much great tech work for us here at Civic Media and has really bailed us out a few times. He'll be helping us out tomorrow night at the remote. But he texted me saying he really liked, not really, but he liked it. Wasn't like he thought it was perfect, but he liked Unfrosted. So I don't know what beverage Chris used. I am so amped up on caffeine, Conrad. I can't even talk. I'm like, honest to God, I'm about to go back on my keto.
Yeah.
But today I had a big soda, like kind of a farewell to soda, and it was a sun drop, and I am literally bouncing off the walls. If there was a trapeze in here, I would be using it.
Did you have a coffee as well?
Well, I had coffee earlier. That's the problem. It's not a good... What'd you have for lunch? Coffee? What about dinner? A sun drop? You don't need that. Steve from the 920, Conrad's dad checking in. Favorite drink when watching a movie at a theater is a large cherry Pepsi with a large bucket of buttery popcorn. Perfection. I'm with you, Steve. Salty sweet, right? Yep. That's the combination. Especially, that's why people love soda and popcorn, soda and hot dogs. Yeah, there's something about... I like popcorn better at the movies, too, because people get, like, the nachos or the heated pretzel, and then they're, like, messing with the wrapping.
Yeah.
For, like, 2 minutes. It's like, honest to God. And it's kind of on the movie theater. Can you find a better way to serve that so they're not ruining everybody's experience? Yeah. Pepsi and popcorn, Coke and popcorn. Dynamite. No argument there, Steve. So that's a good beverage. Some people might say wine, beer. Let's say you're binge watching. Let's say you're sitting down to watch Better Call Saul and you want to bang out like four episodes. Pardon me. What are you pouring yourself? That's the question. 855-752-4842. 855-75-CIVIC. Let us know. I'm having a serious caffeine buzz here tonight. And I feel like I've already done 3 hours of show.
We're only in the second segment.
I've never done drugs, but I don't like, this must be what speed feels like. I don't know. All right. Coming up next, very excited to welcome this gentleman to the show. He wrote a book about Patty Hearst that we will discuss. Author, activist, filmmaker Roger Rappaport, Tracy Schrader is here in the second hour. She's a stand-up comedian based here in Wisconsin. Very funny. I've had the pleasure of working with her one time before, and I'm thrilled she's here in studio tonight. Conrad's looking into Naked Cruise fares. We will get those to you and sign you up. See if we can get like a charity sign-up thing going here. All right, and it's National Beverage Day. What are you pouring? You're sitting down to watch a few episodes of your favorite show. What kind of beverage are you going to enjoy? Let us know. This is Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. We'll be right back on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Did you miss what's hot from Wisconsin to Hollywood? Listen to Nightlight with Pete Schwabe podcast on civicmedia.us. You can always listen through Spotify, Apple Podcast, or the Civic Media app. Take Nightlight with Pete Schwabe anywhere you go. Once again, here is your host, Pete Schwabe.
So, tonight's question, in light of National Beverage Day, is what beverage would you choose when you sit down to watch a movie or TV? And Conrad's dad says a cherry Pepsi and a big old bucket of popcorn. I'm sure he's not on an island there. That's the classic all-American snack and drink. And then we got a caller, Gary from Sussex, says an Arnold Palmer and his wife a diet Arnold Palmer. Boy, that's a good one, too. I haven't had an Arnold Palmer in a long time. It sounds delicious. Thank you, Gary. Keep those texts coming. In the second hour, Tracy Schrader, she's a Wisconsin-based comedian, actually a Northeast Wisconsin-based comedian. She will be here in the studio. That'll be fun. And right now, I'm very excited to welcome this next guest. I met him several years ago on a TV show I host here in Wisconsin on PBS called Director's Cut. And Roger came on the show. He had a film he was talking about that I interviewed him about, and he came on with one of the actors from the film, Richard Reilly, who's been on this show several months ago, and he was just a great guest too. Both great guys, but tonight Roger is here to discuss his book that he wrote about Patty Hearst, and it's very exciting for me to have him here. Roger, how are you?
Doing great. It's great to reconnect.
It sure is. We've swapped emails over the years, and I'm excited that you're very prolific.
Well, it's one way to stay out of trouble.
Well, I think you get into trouble with your projects, though, too, because you do a lot of investigating, and they're probably not always popular with everybody, but that doesn't stop you. That's great.
Yeah, well, it's a great opportunity to share information, not only with people who know the story, but people who don't. In the case of Patty Hearst, a lot of people are discovering who she was because this is the 50th anniversary of her kidnapping, and for those members of your audience who aren't exactly familiar with who Patty Hearst is, she was the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, the original media baron who created a newspaper dynasty, And her grandfather was immortalized in the film Citizen Kane.
Right.
And when she was 19 years old, a student at UC Berkeley, she was kidnapped by the Sudanese Liberation Army. And a few months later, after being kidnapped, decided to join these revolutionaries in a daring bank robbery in San Francisco, and eventually became a member of this revolutionary group, was one of the most FBI's most wanted fugitives, and she fell in love with one of her kidnappers. And the kidnapping took place in February, and this month is another 50th anniversary of another event that almost touched Patty, which was the largest shootout on American soil ever in Los Angeles on May 17th. And this was effectively the end of the Sudanese Liberation Army. She was one of the three surviving members. And among those victims were the founder of the group, Donald DeFries, and the man that she'd fallen in love with, her fellow revolutionary, Willie Wolfe, who died just months after they'd met each other. And she ended up spending the next year and a half on the run all the way across America, trying to carve out a new life with her kidnapper and his wife. There were two SLA members. And that's what the book is about. I covered this story as a journalist in the Bay Area and also wrote a book with the man she was originally intending to marry before the kidnapping, Steve Weed. That didn't quite work out. And then after he was let out of prison some years later, her kidnapper, Bill Harris, was the subject of a long interview that I did. And I also interviewed the coroner who autopsied those six SLA victims after the shootout in Los Angeles. So I've been covering the story for years. And the book, Searching for Patty Hearst, is kind of a 50th anniversary look at the entire story.
So my guest is Roger Rappaport. I don't know if I properly introduced you before we jumped right in there, Roger, but that's a lot to unpack. So Patty Hearst, okay, for those of you that don't know, like Roger just said, she is the granddaughter or great-granddaughter?
The granddaughter of William Randolph.
Granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst. Okay. Was she, all right, and you wrote this book, Searching for Patty Hearst, A True Crime Story, with the assistance of Steve Weed, her fiancé, when she got kidnapped, correct?
That's right. And that book was never published.
Okay.
At the very end, he decided that there was still a chance that if she ever came back, that she would go through with the wedding, which did not happen.
Wow.
So he wrote his own book for her. So my book, the one I ghostwrote for him, never came out. So here I am 50 years later, based on a lot of other interviews. In fact, for example, one of the key judges in the trial in Los Angeles, when she was on the run, she actually defended her kidnapper who was being tackled by a security guard, Bill Harris, and fired about 80 rounds to liberate him. So she had been very involved in this liberating her kidnapper, and they were now on the run. And she and the kidnapper and his wife kidnapped a 17-year-old high school student. So she was now being wanted for bank robbery, kidnapping, and then later two more bank robberies in the Sacramento area. So she was very much on the FBI's most wanted list. And this made the story even more complicated for the family because she was releasing regular tapes denouncing the Hearst family and the corporate power structure, and of course the Vietnam War and a lot of other revolutionary causes. And so she was becoming a very articulate spokeswoman for the revolutionary movement.
So what do you make of, I mean, that's the part that, and I've done a little bit of research on her in addition to reading your book. I'm on like page 80. She was 16 when she met Steve Weed. So she's very,
right.
Very young.
He was her high school math teacher. She was a junior in high school, and she fell in love with her high school math teacher. And then eventually they moved on to UC Berkeley, where they were both students.
Right.
And they had announced their wedding, and that story was read by the Sudanese Liberation Army, this emerging revolutionary group. And they decided she would be the perfect target to get a $4 million ransom out of the Hearst family. piece of cake, right? Well, thanks to Governor Reagan, the Attorney General, and hostage consultants, the family decided not to ransom her. Patty did not take this very well, and she basically couldn't understand why her family claimed they didn't have $4 million because the Hearst Corporation was a multi-billion dollar corporation. Today, the 11th largest family fortune in the country.
Still, and right now they're 11.
So she, they're number 11.
My goodness.
And they're in the double digits in billions. And so she knew that they had the money to ransom her, and she figured that they had written her off, and this did not set well with her. So that's when she began these, decided that she wanted to participate in this bank robbery on camera in a bank owned by the father of a friend of hers, to make everybody understand that she really had gone over to the dark side and had become a revolutionary.
So that was the catalyst for her officially becoming a member of the Seminese Liberation Army. Not that she wasn't brainwashed or had like Stockholm syndrome or something like that.
Well, she's had a multitude of labels: clueless, yeah, wealthy heiress, rebel, young bride to be, kidnapping victim, rape victim, terrorist, fugitive, Stockholm syndrome archetype, criminal defendant, recipient of a presidential pardon. And let's go to that for just a second. She finally was arrested in September of 1975.
Right.
And was convicted and went to jail for 22 months until her sentence was commuted by President Jimmy Carter. And then she was later pardoned by Bill Clinton.
So what do you make of that? I mean, it's so interesting. Like, she meets Steve Weed when she's 16. She's obviously very impressionable. She's kidnapped. Then she falls in love with one of her kidnappers. And then when she gets out of jail, after only a 22-month sentence, she falls in love with the cop that was her bodyguard, correct?
That's correct. That is exactly right. So she went through quite a number of transitions. And I think if you read some of the communiques that she issued, her critique of the American power structure very much echoes a lot of what you're hearing today on college campuses, essentially an attack on, you know, American capitalism, the whole idea that all these colleges, you know, should get rid of all their investments that relate to Israel and so on. So effectively, at that time, it was the Vietnam War. Now, of course, you know, there are other revolutionary causes. But even the right has embraced some of her rhetoric that basically the government can't be trusted at any level. You know, we need to have a new American revolution, so to speak, one way or another. And that's what she was talking about.
Jeez. So what is her relationship like now with her family?
Well, currently she has homes in the New York area in Charleston. She has two married daughters. She is a articulate spokesman, for the Hearst family. Believe it or not, she and one of her cousins, Willie, who I know, have been trying to kind of break open the family will. They've actually been involved in all kinds of litigation because, unfortunately, one of the codicils in her grandfather's will effectively disinherits anybody in the family who files a lawsuit to challenge the will. So in other words, if you just say that the will is not correct and you go to court on that, you immediately are disinherited. So the story just goes on and on.
Wow. I know one of her son-in-laws is Chris Hardwick, who hosts the show Talking Dead and was an MTV
right.
host.
That's right.
She seems to have a good relationship with her daughters, but
yeah, one of her daughters played Abigail Folger, the coffee heiress, who was one of the victims in the Manson murders.
Oh,
so that was an interesting role for her to be playing. And and then Patty herself has done a number of John Waters films as an actress herself. So she's been involved in a number of movies.
What does she do today? What is Patty Hearst? I know her husband, her husband that was the police officer that was her bodyguard passed away, I believe.
That's correct. He died in 2011.
Okay.
And she is very involved in, she breeds show dogs and has won a number of shows, including some in Madison Square Garden. And she also is a philanthropist and she was involved in the Me Too movement. So she's spoken out there. And she selectively gives interviews, mostly around her own work. She did a novel, so she autographed her novel at San Simeon, the family estate. She also has written a book about her experience many years ago, and then there was a film about that. So she gave a lot of, quite a few interviews. One of the interesting facts about the film is that Paul Schrader, the director, changed the ending, and she was not happy about it. He invented an ending to her nonfiction story, and that led to kind of a tussle, you know.
Sure.
If it's not Paul fiction. Said, you know, Paul felt the ending to her book that it just wasn't strong enough. She needed a better ending that would work better. So
a
bit of a battle.
Yeah. I have so many questions. I don't even know where. So what do you believe, Roger, about all the stuff apparently that happened to her when she was with the Symbionese Liberation Army? I mean, you're closest to this story as anyone, probably. What's your take on that?
Well, in my book, Searching for Patty Hearst, that question is examined in great detail. In fact, because it's a fictional book, I'm able to look at this question from all points of view. And that's really the point of the book, is that I want readers, especially younger readers, to understand that anybody who says they have all the answers doesn't know what they're talking about. And your question is a very good one, because it offers readers an opportunity, when they read Searching for Patty Hearst, a chance to come to their own conclusions about whether or not she really was a revolutionary or a terrorist. I think at the time that she was committing these bank robberies, there were three of them.
Let's pick up right there, okay, Roger? We got to do a quick bit of business here, but we'll have more coming up next with the author of Searching for Patty Hearst, a true crime story, Roger Rappaport. That's next on Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Welcome back. My guest is the author of Searching for Patty Hearst, a true crime story, Roger Rappaport. He is an activist, author, and filmmaker. What are you first, Roger? What do you consider yourself to be first?
I consider myself to be a journalist, and that's kind of the basis of everything that I do. And as one yourself, you know that a journalist, you're always learning what you didn't know. And in the case of Patty Hearst, I'm still learning. Believe it or not, on the tour for this book, Searching for Patty Hearst, I was contacted by her kidnapper, Bill Harris. And we had met many years ago when I interviewed him after he got out of jail. And we had a reunion, and he was now able to tell me a lot of new information that he hadn't been able to share. And I also got a call from a number of other people who were involved in the case at critical moments, and I've done a couple stories about this, which are all on the website, pattyhearst.com, which is the book's website. And many, many people showed up at events who had known Patty, who had details to add about the case. So as a journalist, I'm still learning and writing about new details. But if you can imagine being her kidnapper, about to be tackled and arrested for shoplifting, and there's Patty Hearst, the woman you kidnapped 3 months ago, flying over the heads of the security guards to liberate you. A spontaneous act of courage. So there were many things that I learned along the route. One of the most interesting notes, and this is just a fascinating detail. My wife and I were in Morro Bay, very close to San Simeon in California. And a guy came by and, you know, introduced himself. And it turned out that he had worked at the Hearst Ranch very close by. And he explained to my wife that at the ranch, while the FBI, you know, had a national dragnet out for Patty, she was hiding out in a cabin at the Hearst Ranch, which is, you know, pretty, you know, remarkable oversight that the FBI wouldn't have staked out that property. But the key thing, the answer to your question, is I think the point of the book is that we present all points of view. In fact, one of the key scenes in the book takes place in Washington Island, where I'm doing some research. And what I want to say about Patty's behavior is that I think during the time that she was on the run, that she really was part of the team. She had many, many chances to leave. She wasn't even with the SLA members for most of the year and a half when she was on the run after the big shootout in LA that took the lives of six of her fellow revolutionaries. So she could have turned herself in at any point. But I think she understandably was afraid that if she tried to do that, she could get hurt badly.
Right.
And so she had some reluctance to do that. After she was arrested, her lawyer, Effie Bailey, made a series of mistakes and basically wrote a script for her that failed, and that's why she got convicted. And, in the bank robbery case. So at that point, she really didn't have any choice. There really was no option other than to follow the script that Effie Bailey followed. And when that legal defense failed, then they went. The family went to work in Washington to get her sentence commuted and ultimately pardoned.
What were the, I was pretty young at the time, very young. What were the optics like at the time? You've got an heiress, one of the richest families in America, joins this group, commits these crimes and does 22 months in jail and then is pardoned. What were the optics like then when it happened? What was the reaction from people journalists and Americans?
Well, obviously, she was America's sweetheart at the beginning. I mean, everybody loved her.
Right.
This poor innocent girl, being kidnapped out of her townhouse in her bathrobe, and there was endless compassion. People were sending money to the family to try to pay for her ransom and so on. And then when she started issuing these communiques, the entire, media and everybody just jumped all over her. That she had somehow become this crazy radical. So this was in the pre-social media era. But to give you an idea of the attention this story was generating, it actually knocked the Watergate story off the front page. That's how big it was.
Wow.
So people were horrified when she started showing up in Revolutionary Guard, and especially when she started attacking the pig hearse, her own family, and her father especially. One of the things that I learned along the way was that her father had a secret meeting at the San Quentin, been involved in secret negotiations with prisoners in San Quentin who had been part of this revolutionary group to try to get them to go on national television to plead for Patty's release. It actually didn't happen. But this is, some of the new information that I've been gathering, on my tour.
Yeah. When you're here in Wisconsin, Roger, and looking into doing what you're doing in Washington Island, you'll have to come by and I have more questions for you. I don't want you to hang up, but I'm saying I would love to have you in here in person. And Effie Bailey has a history with this area too. He bought part of a helicopter company in Menominee, Michigan, called Enstrom. And he learned about this area when he was defending someone in the My Lai massacre. And he bought a house here and was in the area quite a bit. So he's had a connection to this area, as well. And I didn't know that about, writing a script for Patty Hearst to follow. That's interesting. So what is her life like now? What is she? She's a grandma, she's a mom, and she's an active, or she's still doing these things. Is she active just with philanthropy, as you said, or does she have, what's her life like?
Well, she's spoken out quite emphatically about the will, trying to make sure that that's handled properly. And of course, she can't actually file a lawsuit about it, but she's gone public in Variety about that. She also has attacked Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote a book about her, and the film rights were going to be sold, and she attacked that, and the film deal was killed in about 3 hours. She's been very involved in the Me Too movement, and she's been quite articulate in terms of her own account of what actually happened in the film that Paul Schrader directed. But she's kept a pretty low profile, as a mom and grandma, she's been, very, very, very involved with her family, and she breeds show dogs that have been very successful at it. So that's a pretty good picture of her. By the way, her dad, the one that didn't have $4 million to ransom her, left an estate of $1.5 billion. So I'm hoping that Patty shared in some of that. I really am.
Hey, can you stick around for just a few more minutes, Roger? I want to ask you about Pilot Air. And I want to, you do a really cool thing in the book I want to ask you about too. My guest is Roger Rappaport. He's going to give us a few more minutes. That's coming up next on Nightlight with Pete Schwabe on the Civic Media Radio Network.